I got a fax machine actually. Nobody really had one at the time, 1988 or something. I don't know. Some businesses had them, but not people. And I told him about it. He went out and bought one. Then we just started faxing crazy stuff to each other. I mean, he had one fax. There's a picture of him sitting in Elvis's lap saying, "Could Charlie T. Wilbury Sr. be Elvis Presley's kid?" But it's just, I can't even explain. You have to look at these faxes to really understand what I'm talking about. But Tom, it shows a different side of Tom's.
This seems weird, doesn't it? I mean, who gets excited over a fax machine? It's clunky and loud and takes forever, and the quality isn't amazing. In 2020, in 1988, Apple may as well just released their first iRobot. It was a huge deal, and Tom Petty got swept away in the novelty of it. All thanks to his good friend, John Scott.
There's a fun side of Tom, and he doodles on the faxes and just said crazy little things. And I saved every one of them. I've still got them and preserved, and they're still on thermal paper. But I love the faxes, man. So then we came up with the idea to do a Traveling Wilbury fax promotion, which I had never heard of anybody doing. Maybe they had, but I got every fax number from every FM station in America, and asked Tom if he would just send him a fax. And he said, "Hell yeah, I'll do it." But 100. So he started doing it, and he just all of a sudden he would get responses back. Well, I would get phone calls going, "Hey, is that really Tom that faxed us?" And so his phone number was up on the fax. So he started getting faxes back from the radio stations. And he was like, then he was a kid in a candy store, man. So he just kept doing them, sending out those faxes. And it was called the Traveling Wilbury Fax Promotion. One of my favorites is Tom faxed me and said, "Hey, anybody home? Can you send me anything so I can show Roger McGuinn how this fax machine works?" And so I sent something back to Tom. "Hey, Roger, I'm a fan of yours, and here's how the fax machine works." Then I get a fax back from Roger McGuinn going, "John, thank you so much for the fax demo, Roger McGuinn." Now I'm sitting there going, "This is so cool, man. Are you kidding me?" So we just had a ball. I mean, we did a lot of things, just kind of did these ideas just kind of came off the cuff, you know?
That was the ethos of Tom. He didn't plan. He was the rambling troubadour, the strumming vagabond, an American treasure. His music became the soundtrack to the hardships and the victories of his fans. He's not dead. He's forever free falling. Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie O'Kupniak. Those wispy blonde locks, that steel jaw, and those vibrant vocal cords were destined for greatness. Tom grafted and struggled to get his music career off the ground. He was born in Gainesville, Florida in 1950. Gainesville was a very small town, but it had a university in the city limits, and it was surrounded by farms. It had this incredible mixture of intellectuals and working class people. Tom, as a child, loved westerns, and he even wanted to learn how to play guitar because cowboys played guitars. I mean, it's adorable. He idolized Elvis. When he was younger, Elvis was in town making a movie, and Tom's aunt was able to bring him to the set to meet him. It wasn't a grandiose meeting, but it always stayed with him. Home life for Tom, it was rough. His father was physically and verbally abusive. Tom, his younger brother, and his mother found comfort and support in each other and in music. Tom became obsessed with rock and roll. He constantly played records, and it was all he ever talked about. When he was 13 years old and saw the Beatles perform on the Ed Sullivan Show, everything changed.
Introducing the Beatles again. May I point out that they'll be on our show, as I told our audience, for the next two Sundays. Next Sunday from Deauville Hotel in the Miami Beach show, starring Hollywood's exciting Mitzi Gaynor. But ladies and gentlemen, once again...
He begged his father for money to buy an electric guitar, and eventually he gave in. Tom ran out into the neighborhood looking for anybody who knew how to play an instrument. He needed to form a band. He played bass in a band called the Epics. They began growing out their hair and played their first gig at a school dance. They had only rehearsed a handful of songs, but they were a hit. And when the audience wanted more, they just played the same songs over and over again. The band realized if they wanted to be taken seriously, they needed to write original songs and change their name. That was when Tom dropped out of high school, around 17, and they formed Mudcrutch. Mudcrutch was the name of the farm two of the bandmates lived in, and eventually the rest of the band moved on the farm too. It became a bit of a wayward home for musicians. Their gigs were a combination of cover songs and original music. Tom became more of the front man in the band, and he began cracking the ice on his music writing skills. They started playing gigs regularly, but they realized there were few places in Gainesville for live music at the time. One summer day, they decided to host a music festival on the Mudcrutch farm. They built a stage, they asked the local co-op to bring over free food, and invited bands to play for the weekend. It was a great success, with a few hundred attendees. By the third festival, it had grown beyond their capacity. They had lost control. Thousands of people started to come, some from out of state. They had to shut it down. They had reached their limitations in Gainesville, so they decided to record a demo. And Tom drove to L.A. to court a record label. With no appointments booked, he began knocking on doors playing the demo. A lot of execs laughed them out of the room. Tom walked into a phone booth to try and book the next appointment. And while he was on the phone, he looked down and saw someone had left a list of 25 record labels and their phone numbers. He felt good and bad about this. Good because now he had a shortcut to get where he wanted to go. Bad, because he realized there must be a lot of people just like him trying to do exactly the same thing. He managed to get an appointment with MGM, and they listened to the whole demo. They offered them a deal to record a single. The next appointment was with London Records, and when they heard the demo, they offered to make an album. Tom couldn't be more ecstatic, and he headed back to Gainesville to grab the rest of the band and bring them to LA. The band sold everything they had. With the little money they were able to put together, they rented a U-Haul, had enough gas money and food money for 9 people to move all the way out from Florida to Los Angeles, with only $200 to spare to live off of in LA. While they were getting their affairs in order, a music producer by the name of Denny Cordell called Tom and offered him a deal. Denny was famous for making bands like the Moody Blues and Joe Cocker a success. Tom knew exactly who he was on the phone and was stunned. He told Denny, "Thanks so much, but we're on our way to LA. We've already got a few offers." Denny said, "I'm in Oklahoma. Swing by on your way to LA and come see my studio." So they decided to take a chance, and after Denny heard them play in the recording studio, he offered them a deal instantly. He pulled out some contracts and a big old wad of cash to get them to LA. The band obviously had stars in their eyes, and away they went. The record label put them up in a couple of houses in LA, and the guys were on cloud 9. Granted, the houses had no furniture, and the guys were broke. But they did hit the studio. John Scott was a record promoter at the time, and he didn't realize when he played their cassette that he was listening to greatness.
Funny thing, I was driving to Nashville with Olivia Newton-John, and MCA gives these cassettes that you listen to of all the new artists, and we put it in, and she heard Mudcrutch, Depot Street, and she said, "You know, that's quite good." I said, "You know, I kind of like this song. It's cool." cool reggae song. And so I went to an FM station there, my first day on the job. I don't know, something like that, but close. And they added the record because they thought Mudcrutch was, the song was really good. And so I called the ad in to my, you know, I got it played on our station to my boss, and he said, you know, forget Mudcrutch, it's just a single, and, you know, go work the Olivia Newton-John album. So I just forgot about Mudcrutch, and I had no idea who was in the band. It didn't say, just a cassette. And so, you know, some 3 or 4 years later, all of a sudden I'm sitting in front of a guy who was Mudcrutch, and we're just looking at each other like, wow, this is crazy. This is kind of crazy because you're telling me you're going to break my career. You knew me as Mudcrutch. There was only 3 stations in America that played Mudcrutch. And he said, you're probably the biggest Mudcrutch fan around, which I was, but I didn't have any idea either. I had no idea.
Tom married his girlfriend, Jane, and they had 2 kids. He was motivated and focused on reaching a bigger audience with the band. But when the record label failed to promote their single, the band broke up. Tom didn't give up, though. Shelter Records saw promise in him and offered him a solo contract. Mike and Ben from Mudcrutch courted a drummer and a bassist they knew from Gainesville who just happened to be in LA at the same time, and they formed a new band. They invited Tom to come and listen to them jam in his studio, and Tom instantly realized that this needed to be his backing band, and he stole them. The next step was giving the band a name. Their first choice was Nitro. Shot down. Tom loved the idea of calling the band the King Bees. The band was not pleased. Tom was inspired by a song and pitched calling the band the Heartbreakers. Tom and Denny created the iconic logo of the heart with the flying V guitar sticking straight through it and the ribbons surrounding it with the band's name.
It was all meant to be. I really believe that things were meant to happen. And I think this particular thing, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, was meant to happen. And it wasn't at the time. And it was all serendipitous, I believe. So I went to my office, like, I don't know, this is like maybe 3 days later. And I opened my closet to get my jacket, and this album kind of fell out in a white jacket with nothing on it except it said 10-76. And I kind of assumed, well, maybe it came out in 76, but I didn't know. And I pulled the vinyl out. There was nothing on that, no song titles, no name of the band. And I'm a music nut. I said, I've got to listen to this. I don't know what it is, but already it intrigues me. And I sat down and I heard Rocking Around With You, and I kind of went, whoa. And then I heard Breakdown, and I really went, whoa, what the hell is this? And of course, the American Girl ends the side two, I believe. And I was like in a trance after I heard that first album. I sat there, I was almost shaking. Like I had heard something that was a game changer in rock and roll. And I put my headphones on and listened again. And if you've never listened to Tom Petty's first album on the headphones, man, those vocals going every which way and harmonies going left to right, right to left. It's really cool. But after the second time, I was really in a trance, not knowing what to do except run to my boss's office and go, who are these guys? I'm holding up a white album cover. And he puts the disc on and says, oh, 10 seconds. And says, oh, that's Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, that punk band. We're dropping them. And when he said the word punk band, if you know Tom Petty, you know he's not a punk band. I mean, it just takes listening to 3 or 4 songs in that first album to know he's a rock and roll star. But anyway, so he said, we're dropping him because it's been out for 8 months and it's only sold 12,000 copies. And there's a few stations who liked it. One in, you know, some in San Francisco, San Jose, Boston, Chicago, but nothing really happened. So they were going to drop him because they'd spent a pretty good amount of money. And I asked him, I said, can I try to get this record played with my radio buddies? He said, no, we're dropping him. And I really just kind of got down on my knees. I mean, I knew what I heard. I got on my knees and begged him for 6 weeks. Just give me 6 weeks and I promise you I will stop. Nothing happens within 6 weeks. And he said, you know, go ahead. This is an unbankable punk band. I don't know what you're doing, but you know, I was in heaven at that point, to be honest with you. Because all of a sudden this band was my new favorite band. I went back in and listened again, make sure I wasn't, you know, whatever. And I heard it again and it just blew me away. So I started calling radio buddies and most of them had not heard of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Most of them said, isn't that punk band? Anyway, so I found out they were playing 2 days later at the Whiskey A Go-Go in Los Angeles by accident, opening for Blondie.
Here she comes now.
So I went to one of my best friends in the world, just moved to Los Angeles, started a station, probably been on the air for a week. I went over to his house and played it for him, and he flipped out like I did. He said, this is a game changer for rock and roll. And I was excited. I asked him to go to the Whiskey with me, which was 2 days later. And by chance, I picked up a Melody Maker. And I saw a review of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And it was really a great review. And I'm going, wait a minute, why is he happening in London? And nobody knows who he is here. But in the back of my mind, I kind of went, well, there's a little validation for you. So we went to see Tom Saturday night opening for Blondie, maybe 15, 20 people in the club. And he just blew us away. They came out looking cool as hell. You know, Tom had a scarf on, strapped a flying V on, and did Oh Carol, you know, by Chuck Berry's song. And then I think Breakdown was about the third song he did. And Charlie Kendall, my buddy, leaned over and said, I'm going to start playing this record on Monday morning. And I'm going to play the hell out of it. It's a hit record. And so, man, when you're a promotion man and some guy, a record guy says, I'm going to start playing your record, you're on cloud nine, you know. And so I figured they played about a 40-minute set, and they really blew us away. I mean, we looked at each other like our eyes were glazed, like, what the hell? This is incredible. So I go upstairs. I'm kind of naive at this, but I like, you know, hanging out with artists and working with artists. And so I just went upstairs to try to find this guy, Tom Petty, to tell him what's going to happen on K-West. And I went upstairs, and he was pretty easy to spot. And I said, hey, Tom, my name is John Scott. I'm the new head of album promotion at ABC. And he said, I don't give a damn who you are. And I went, well, no, I'm like the new guy. He said, I don't give a shit who you are. Because they had been worked over by the machine. ABC Records didn't promote him. They promoted him in teen magazines. They promoted him as a punk band, not a rock and roll band. Anyway, so Tom looked up to the band. Was all in the room. They were changing clothes. It was a really simple little small room, no security. And Tom yelled out, hey, Stan, this is the new guy at ABC Records. What do we call ABC Records? And he said, ABC stands for a bunch of cocksuckers. And they're starting to laugh at me. I'm really, you know, my face is turning red, but I didn't care because I had heard it by that time. And then I had seen it. So I didn't care what the hell they were saying to me. It was like flying over my head. And I asked Tom if he'd ever heard his record on the radio in Los Angeles. And he said, no. I said, well, you're going to hear it Monday morning. He was like, okay, get out of here. You guys are two ABC nut jobs. And that's all you've done is screw up our career for 8 months. And something, I don't know what it was, but I started, the guy came over and started ushering us out. But for some reason, I just turned around and I really don't know why I said it. I mean, I do know why I said it, but I didn't know at the time. Tom Petty, I'm going to break your career wide open. And we get the hell out of here. And then at that point, I turned around and I said, Tom, my name is John Scott. Every time you hear your record on the radio, you're going to think of me, okay? And he was like, yeah, yeah, right, right, right. So we left the club, Charlie and I, and we went back to his house, put on the record again to make sure we weren't crazy. And we knew we weren't crazy. We saw it, heard it. And Monday morning, Charlie started playing it like crazy. And by Wednesday, the biggest record store in town, Tower Records, called ABC and wanted to order 250 copies because they were getting phone calls about Breakdown. And so, you know, the head of sales came in like, what the hell's going on here? You know, this, we were going to drop this band. And I said, not anymore. And so he just kind of shook his head and left. Anyway, So I just went on a mission. The following Wednesday, his manager calls me, and I can't do an English voice very well, but he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm John Scott." He said, "Why are you pissing off my artist by telling him you're going to break his career?" I said, "Well, I am." And he was going, "You know, who are you?" I said, "I'm the new guy here. That's all. I just like your band's record." So we set up a meeting, and I immediately discovered that Tony Dimitriotis was an incredible manager and had the best interest in his band. We had a great meeting, and 2 days later, my assistant comes in and says, "Hey, Tom Petty's on the phone." And I'm kind of going, "Oh boy, this is either going one way or the other. I don't know." But I picked up the phone. He said, "He's got like, he's from the South. He's got a Southern drawl." He said, "John, my friends are telling me they're hearing the record like you said. And are you serious?" I said, "Tom, I'm going to break your career." And he just said, "I want to meet you. Can you come over to my house tonight?" And I flew there. And I scribbled, probably, I think it was in Reseda, I don't know. But I scribbled the address down and put in the cassette and took off. And when I got to his, I can't remember if it was an apartment or a house, I can't remember. And turns out he was born in Florida and I was born in Florida. And I didn't know that. And so that's cool. We hit it off right away. And we went outside to smoke a peace pipe, as I called it. And I told him again what I was going to do. And then I asked him about have you been in any other bands? He said, "No, you've never heard of them. They're called Mudcrutch." And I went, "Oh my God, what?" I mean, we just looked at each other for 10 seconds and like chill bumps. I had chill bumps going, "I'm looking at this guy who's Mudcrutch. And now he's my favorite band in the world. Good God, what are the odds of that?" And so he went inside and played me "Listening to Her Heart," the song they've been working on. And I went, "Holy crap, that's even better than stuff on the first album, in my opinion." And although the first album was incredible. But so I just I left his house and he walked me out and I told him again what I was going to do. And he kind of shook his head. "Yeah, right, sure." And although I knew he kind of believed a little bit of it, but I guess after 8 months, you didn't really want to believe in anything because nothing had happened in the United States. So I just went on a one-man mission after that, calling radio stations, flying into cities, not playing it. I just went crazy.
John was true to his word. He hustled, and he hustled hard.
Every FM station in America started playing the live version of Breakdown. And that's the point in history of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers that his life changed, when people started playing that live Breakdown. And my boss finally came in and said, "Okay, you did it. You're 179 on the charts." And I just couldn't believe it. He shows it to me.
After touring in Europe, the album finally made it onto the British charts. These kids let loose in Europe and had the time of their life. They made it cool to like American music abroad. The band enjoyed fame and the freedoms available in Europe that they didn't have in America. After a trip to Amsterdam, the band purchased more pot than they could possibly smoke. Stan, the drummer, was stopped at customs on the way to Berlin for residue in a peace pipe. Residue. While they were held in lockup, Ron, the bassist, ate his huge brick of hashish before he could get caught. And even though the band had been detained and Ron was flying high, they still made it in time to perform live for TV, and they put on one hell of a show. Breakdown made it to 40 on the charts in the States, and American Girl would become an American classic. But the band did not have the level of fame that they had in Europe. Yet. Rock and roll had evolved into these long ballads. Disco was on the way out. But at this time, there was a small group of alternative rock and punk music that was creeping up the charts. The Clash, the Sex Pistols, Patti Smith, and Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were gaining traction. When MCA bought Shelter Records, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers wanted to walk away. They argued that they signed a publishing deal under duress because the record label offered them a record deal only if they signed a publishing contract as well. The record labels wrote a loophole in their contracts stipulating they would deduct the cost of making the record out of the band's royalties, and the record label would acquire the copyright to their songs. Tom was furious. He certainly didn't understand this when he signed as a naive teenager. It was a David and Goliath moment. The record company held firm, telling him he didn't have the money to fight it. So Tom declared bankruptcy. This was a big deal, because if Tom succeeded, then he would set a precedent for record companies in America and how they treated their artists. He was scared, but when he was confronted by the man, he was steel. He sat in boardrooms, cleaning his nails with a penknife and sticking it to the man. Not literally. Tom has admitted he wasn't doing this to be threatening. He was just bored and wanted to do something. But whatever the reason, it was effective. In order to pay for the legal bills, the band did a short tour called the Lawsuit Tour, and they sold shirts that said, "Why, MCA?" Tom was very strict while touring. No girls, no groupies, strictly business.
I always wanted to be on the road with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers because I witnessed history every night. And I mean it, every night. One night, six encores. And they wanted more. We were a small place, but they wanted more. And I went afterwards, I said, "You could have done another encore." He said, "That's all the songs we know."
The band recorded the album Damn the Torpedoes while in court with the record label. They experimented with new recording styles, new sounds, and new techniques. Schisms began to form within the band, but the album is what kept their head above water with the uncertainty in the court. Tom knew he had to keep a level head and keep plowing forward. While in the recording studio, he asked a friend to relabel all of the recordings and hide them each day. He never wanted to know where the tapes were, so if he was asked to produce them in court, he couldn't. The crew even ran drills to see how quickly they could get the tapes off of the reel-to-reel machine and into the car. The record company realized Tom wasn't going to buckle, so they called him to the settlement table. MCA refused to release them from their recording contract, but they agreed to release the publishing rights back to the band. They offered Tom his own record label to have creative control, but they wanted to distribute the records. Tom agreed and formed Backstreet Records. Their first release was Damn the Torpedoes.
Tom he doesn't back down to people. I mean, he's the nicest guy in the world, but he doesn't back down to people. And he does it in a way that, not threatening, but he's stubborn.
He never forgot how hard it was to get out there, and he wanted to pay it forward to struggling bands.
He was the kind of guy, I remember taking over Georgia Satellites. And the minute he heard that one song, I can't remember the name of it, "Pretty Little Thing, Let Me Light Your Candle," because I'm sure hard to handle it. He called his manager and said, "I'm with him on my next tour." And so, and they went out. And the same thing happened with Tommy Two Tone, 867-5309. He heard that record and again called his manager and said, "I want this band on my next tour." So he kind of went with his gut feeling like we all did. You know, it was all for the music. It was all about passion.
Tom was revered as a songwriter and as a music producer. Artists like Stevie Nicks began to pursue Tom and collaborate. Together, they recorded a song for the Hard Promises album and the hit single, "Stop Dragging My Heart Around." We have some sponsors who would like to serenade you, but when we come back, we'll hear how the voice of American idealism won't back down. After a few years experimenting with music videos, producing hit records, and being on tour for almost 5 years straight, it's gonna take its toll. The band stopped touring, and the drugs they used to fuel themselves on the road suddenly were becoming more of an anchor around their neck. Tom realized they were struggling to record simple things in the studio. They just weren't connecting or making sense. He played the band's original demo and realized how much better they were in comparison to what they were making. Out of frustration, Tom hit his left hand against a wall and pulverized it. He was told he may never play again. After several operations, doctors were able to help Tom to recover. It was the wake-up call Tom needed, and he decided to sober up. Southern Accents is the band getting back to their friendships and their love of music. It's wacky and playful. It got the band on tour again and back on track. Tom Petty was offered the opportunity to tour with Bob Dylan as his opening act and backup band, and Tom leapt on it. They traveled the world together for years. The band has said those years on tour were some of the best for them. During the tour, Tom's house caught on fire while his family was still asleep inside. The next day was a barbecue birthday party for Tom's wife, Jane. And as the fire was beginning to subside, guests started to arrive outside the house. Friends like Annie Lennox and Stevie Nicks stood in the driveway with the family as all of Tom's memorabilia just went up in smoke. While taking shelter in a hotel, Annie Lennox greeted the whole family with a new wardrobe. Fire investigators told Tom the fire was arson. He couldn't believe it, but the investigators walked him around the property and showed him the ring around the house where the arsonist poured the accelerant and set the fire. People all over the country started to confess, but they never caught the arsonist. Tom had to go back on tour, but after the fire, he wanted to keep his family and his friends close. He packed up the family and used the tour as a working therapy. His family have said it was some of the happiest times for them. While in London, Tom began to hang out with George Harrison and Jeff Lynne. They were all big fans of Roy Orbison, and he happened to want to release an album around the same time. George recruited Tom to write a song for Roy, and out of that came "Anything You Want, You Got It." A classic! The guys would bump into each other in strange places, and if the stars aligned, they might even spontaneously jam.
Christmas, him and his wife, Jane, at the time, picked out gifts for everybody individually. I mean, nobody got the same gift. They just had people who were coming on a list, and they wrote down and look up, and they were buying stuff that they knew I would want, or a friend, or whoever would want. And I remember him buying me a retro, really retro, maybe in the 50s, I don't know, it was a radio, it's classic. But anyway, he knew I would like it. And but that was the kind of thing that happened. Then, you know, I think everybody would open up presents and then have dinner. And then all of a sudden there was the jam session afterwards, and you never knew who was coming. And it would be Bruce Springsteen or Jeff Lynne or George Harrison. We always played softball before lunch, and he was always the pitcher. He didn't like running. And so we found the softball of the bats, but we couldn't find the softballs. And Tom jumps in his car and says, "I'm going down to the drugstore to get some softballs." And as legend has it, that's when he pulls up to a stop sign and looks to his right, and there's Jeff Lynne. And all of a sudden, they realize that they live near each other. I think Jeff invited him to come over and hear the Roy Orbison album that Jeff Lynne was producing. So, you know, that was kind of fate in a way, lost softballs, and all of a sudden Jeff Lynne, then Roy Orbison, and then George Harrison had left a guitar at Tom's house, and he came over and got it, and all of a sudden they just talked about going to a Roy session, or I think it was George, actually, I don't know. But anyway, that's how things happen. He's driving down the street, come on. Look, you're right, there's, you know, one of my idols, too, from Electric Light Orchestra, Jeff Lynne. But God, they were fun. Holidays were so much fun with the Petties. Every day was fun with them, but particularly holidays.
What happens when George Harrison, Jeff Lynne, Bob Dylan, Roy Orbison, and Tom Petty get together and want to jam? Brilliant music happens, people. The supergroup, the Traveling Wilburys, forms.
It was either Bob Dylan's session or Roy Orbison's session. Or what it was, I think George needed a second he needed a second song for the single that they put out, and he didn't have it. And I think he invited Tom over and Jeff to help him do a B-side, which basically was a throwaway single. But all of a sudden, the B-side was better than the first side. And I guess that's when the Traveling Wilburys kind of hit it. I don't know, man. All I know is that the Traveling Wilburys were just knocked me out.
Originally, it was just a bunch of friends getting together and playing around with music, and it escalated into a super group. They released The Traveling Wilburys Volume 1, and it was a tremendous critical and commercial success. Dylan's career and Petty's career both were revitalized. Unfortunately, this euphoric happening was rather short-lived. Roy Orbison passed away, and the band felt they couldn't continue the Traveling Wilburys without the source that brought them together. Meanwhile, Tom was writing with Jeff Lynne a lot. But Jeff decided that he wanted to go back to England, and Tom wanted to record the tracks that they had been writing before he went away. So he called Mike Campbell, his longtime guitarist, and they recorded the songs a lot faster than he realized. Tom didn't want to leave the Heartbreakers, and he didn't want to hurt the band. He just wanted to flex his musical muscles and do things the Heartbreakers couldn't do as a band.
He saw it as something just to change of pace. And he had a lot of songs in him, and I think Ben was out of town or Stan was out of town, whatever. Mike might have been out of town, but he just decided to put stuff down. And I think Jeff Lynne came calling and you know, said I want to produce this record. And I think it kind of happened in an instant. And so all of a sudden, just Tom Petty, and I'm sure the other guys in the band, I know the other guys in the band were a little bit hurt, but probably understood in the long run.
Full Moon Fever was a tremendous success. You can't listen to Free Fallin' without shouting the refrain at the top of your lungs. A song that, ironically, Heartbreakers bassist Howie Epstein refused to play in the studio because he didn't like it. The greats are made with movers and shakers, and Tom embodies that philosophy and delivers it to each individual fan every time they hear his music and see him play.
I turned around and went, Tom, this is some of the best stuff you've ever recorded in your life. And I really meant that, you know, Free Falling and I Won't Back Down, Running Down a Dream. He said, thank you. And Tony said, we have a problem though. MCA doesn't wants us to go back into the studio. They think there's no hits on this record. And I'm like bumfuzzled because I'm going, what? That's hit after hit after hit on that album. And they asked me, you know, did I know anybody at MCA? And I still did. So I called my friend over there who was head of album promotion. He had just gotten there to MCA, and he had told me before he wanted to meet Tom. So I said, come on over and hear the new album. And the next night he did. And he basically, you know, said the same exact thing as I did. He turns to Tom and said, you know, Tom, this is some of the best stuff you've ever done in your life. This is mind-blowing. And Tom again, or Tony says, we have a problem. Your record company doesn't want to put it out as is. And he went, you're kidding me. And he looked at Tom. He said, Tom, I'm going to take care of this. And this guy was not a vice president, I don't think. He wasn't one of the big muckety mucks. He went the next day to a meeting in a big round conference table. And somebody said, has anybody else got anything to say? And he got on top of the table, started jumping up and down and said, who the hell is stopping this Tom Petty record from coming out? There's hits galore. And he started jumping up and down as hard as he could. And people were like, holy crap. And I think 2 weeks later, the album came out as is. And of course, it was another breakthrough album for Tom.
Tom was an observer of humanity and a playful prankster. He got into all sorts of trouble, both on and off stage. But when you add a new piece of technology to that mix, Tom's just a kid in a candy store.
Roger McGuinn, I think I went over to Tom's house. Roger was staying with Tom, and I went over to meet Roger. And Roger was a scanner, police scanner freak. He had like two or three police scanners with him. And at the time, you not only heard the police signals, but you could hear people's cell phone calls on these scanners that Roger had. And Tom got one, and we just sometimes would just sit there all night. And one day on a Sunday, I was listening to my scanner, and I heard Tom's assistant, Alan Bugs Wydell. He went, "Hey, don't tell anybody, but Tom's here with Bob Dylan, and it's freaking us out. It's incredible." And so, you know, Tom's really excited. He's really excited. And the next day, I think I call Tom and go, "Hey, Tom, how's it going with Bob Dylan?" He says, "How do you know I'm working with Bob Dylan?" Well, and then I went and showed him, and he got into police scanners that could hear. You can't do it anymore, but you could hear people's phone. I mean, their phone calls for a short period of time. But yeah, he got into scanners.
The band regrouped and recorded Into the Great Wide Open. While shooting the cover art, Johnny Depp and Faye Dunaway visited their trailers. That's when the concept for the video developed, and they asked the stars to be Eddie and the Fairy Godmother in the music video. They couldn't be more thrilled.
And now I'd like to tell you the story of Eddie and his adventures in the Great Wide Open.
The video itself was 7 minutes long, very unconventional for MTV at the time. But it played constantly and unedited. Tom had quite the history of experimental music video making. He was well known for it, and he did not disappoint. Tom was past borders and labels and anchors. His life was a roller coaster, and the music was his tracks. Wildflowers was Tom's sophomore solo album, and it continued to give him an outlet for artistic freedom. Echo was his divorce album from Jane. The Last DJ was Tom's homage to a time in music that was disappearing with government regulations and media conglomerates. He married Dana in 2001, and in 2002, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. In 2008, the Heartbreakers performed the Super Bowl halftime show. And 30 years after they had originally got together, Tom reunited Mudcrutch for nostalgia and fun. Tom reunited with the Heartbreakers to record the live studio album Mojo. And in 2014, they released the album Hypnotic Eye. It was their first album ever to hit number one in the charts. Tom was an incredibly loyal friend. He never forgot the shoulders that held him up throughout his career. He may have lost a few friends along the way, but he never let that get him down. And when he got the chance to pay tribute, he would.
So I'm sitting there with my daughter, and I think the fourth song, I don't think he'd said a word to the crowd until the fourth song. He stopped the show and did a shout out to me for what I did in 1977. And he played I Won't Back Down because he knew that neither one of us would back down. And that's the song he dedicated to me. I mean, I almost came out of my seat. I was crying. I remember I was like crying, laughing. I don't know what the feelings were, but as I look at it now, it was like a gift he left me, that shout out, because he didn't do it for anybody else. And I didn't know it was coming. And thank God I was there with my daughter. And one of the most exciting times of my life.
We're going to do this song here. It's called Dreams of Flying. And one of my friends is here, and who did so much work with us back in the old days of radio. And he took a big chance on us. And he actually worked the first Mudcrutch single, Depot Street. He was the only guy that got it on the radio. And he's here tonight. I'm going to dedicate this song to him and Sizzle in Memphis, John Scott.
John Scott!
I mean, she'd gone, come up and grew up with the Pettys, you know. And so, yeah, she was pretty flipped out, as I was. I remember asking Mike Campbell after the show. I mean, Tom never stuck around, really. As the more he got famous, he never really stuck around because he was uncomfortable with crowds. And I told Mike, I said, man, I couldn't believe he did that. And he said, man, he didn't even tell us he was going to do it. And so, yeah, that was like the thrill of a lifetime. But 1 week later, he's gone. And it's so hard to wrap my head around it still to this day, that that's even possible.
The 40th anniversary tour for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers wrapped up in September 2017. A week after performing at the Hollywood Bowl, Tom had a heart attack at home, and he was rushed to the hospital. He died on October 2nd, 2017. He was 66 years old. Tom had suffered multi-system organ failure caused by a lethal combination of painkillers he was taking as pain management. He had knee pain and a fractured hip, but he insisted on honoring his commitments and to continue touring for his fans, even though he was in extreme pain.
I think I was watching TV with my daughter was over here, I think. And my wife and we were watching TV, and I think a bulletin came over and said that Tom Petty had died. And we're like, what? And then all of a sudden another bulletin came on saying, he's still alive. But, you know, it was like Rolling Stone was saying this or something, I think. And we were all praying, oh, my God, please, and please. And so the next day it came out that he had accidentally overdosed. And I remember running to my Facebook page. And just going, no. But I wrote it no about 100 times. And I really couldn't control myself because of all the things we had been through. It was impossible to believe. And I knew he'd had some aches and pains. And I saw him in Memphis in 2017. And I asked him how he was backstage. And he said, hey, I got a few aches and pains, but I'm getting through it. And I remember Steve Ferroni, the drummer, kind of helping him up. Tom was in front and Steve Ferroni was in back, and Steve's kind of pushing him a little bit. And I said, that's kind of weird. But I had never knew anything about a fracture of the hip or anything like that. But I think he just wanted to do it for the fans. And I think he wanted to, you know, I think he wanted to make it. It wasn't the cause of money. He didn't need money, but he wanted to do it for the fans. And it was the 40th anniversary. On Facebook, there's one Tom Petty Nation fan club. It's got like 32,000 people. And these people are still grieving. They're still crying. They're still, I mean, to be honest with you, I haven't wrapped my head around it either. Because it's like 2019, and it's time for Tom to tour. And you just kind of go, geez, I can't believe it.
Tom Petty worked with Stevie Nicks, Annie Lennox, George Harrison, Bob Dylan, Johnny Cash, Dave Grohl, and countless other icons. When generations can share a joy in music, it's better than a first date.
Everywhere I go, I mean, and I filmed, I was at Costco, and I filmed the lady, she said at the checkout counter, she said, oh my God, I love Tom Petty. And I looked at the guy on the left, I said, do you like Tom Petty? He said, who doesn't? And that's basically true. Who does not like Tom Petty? But for people who don't get it, I don't even really try to explain it except just listen to a few tracks. But I can't explain to people that don't get it. Either they just weren't growing up at the right time, or they didn't have somebody who turned them on like their dad, or vice versa. There's a lot of kids out there that they've turned their parents on to Tom Petty. So Tom Petty was a genius songwriter, an American icon. He wrote songs about the common man. He was a good guy, a good man, a funny guy. I mean, truly, really funny guy. And if you ever got to hang around with him, you'd know that Tom Petty is a genuine, genuine icon and an American treasure.
You can read all about John Scott and Tom Petty's friendship in his book, Tom Petty and Me, by John Scott, My Rock and Roll Adventures with Tom Petty. You can find that on his website, tompettyandme.com, or on Amazon. Next on A Life Lived.
I remember being in the studio one day where she was kind of like doing some crunches. I was like, no, but you have to do them like this. And I said, you know, it's more like a Pilates class. Like, you should take a Pilates class. And she looked at me like, Gordon, me, Whitney Houston, Pilates, really? In Atlanta, Georgia, me? Like, and I remember at that moment thinking like, wow, she really like lives in a bubble. Cause I thought a third of thought of her is just like, you know, the suburban Atlanta, not quite housewife, but you know, woman living in Atlanta. Like, hey, there's probably a great Pilates class in Alpharetta. Like, go take one, you know what I mean?
It's a strange life when you can bring audiences the size of small towns to tears and inspire them to spring out of their seats and dance, but you can't take a Pilates class with them. Producer and singer Gordon Chambers tells us what it was like to work with Whitney Houston and spend time with her family. This is an Audio Boom original production by Muddy Knees Media and Breaking Stereotypes. This podcast was presented and executive produced by me, Stephanie Okupniak. Our series editor has been Lucy Oliva. If there is an icon that you would like to know more about, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @alifelived_.